This past month, we've been going through a new series that we've called Pursuit of Happiness. And we've been walking through the Beatitudes, which are, you know, one of the earliest recorded teachings of Christ. And, you know, as we've been walking through these Beatitudes, it's kind of Jesus' way of conveying what true happiness is about, or what does it mean to really be blessed. And so he talks about, you know, how it's those who are poor, those who mourn, right, those who show mercy, those are the ones that are blessed. And he goes on to list all these things that seem to contradict what we might understand as happiness, or what we might understand as being blessed. And in a way, he's trying to tell us that if you want to develop true happiness, you need to pursue this counterintuitive way of life. And then after the Beatitudes, he keeps teaching, and he actually makes this one statement. He says, to be perfect as my Heavenly Father is perfect. Because there's a high standard for us. And Paul kind of said the same thing when he said in Philippians that we need to be imitators of God, which is not an easy task. And when we think of imitating something, right, usually we look at the physical attributes. You know, we look at, you know, what's on the outside, and then we try to mimic that, right? In the world of knockoffs, right, that they try to make it look like the original, whether it's shoes or shirts or, you know, purses. And obviously, there are some really bad examples, right? I think I've got a few here. We've got, I think the first one is the Converse Ball Stars. Yeah. And then we also have the Pumua shoes, yeah, the Pumua. And we also have the Sididsa, also known as Adidas, right? You might know it as Adidas. But the idea is, right, that when you try to imitate something, the key is to copy the look and feel, and also try to get the spelling right. But, you know, a lot of times they end up using lower quality material, right? So the focus is entirely on the physical attributes, not necessarily the quality of the product. The same thing when, you know, someone's trying to impersonate someone. You look at how maybe they talk, you try to copy how they look, you know, their mannerisms, some of their behaviors. I ran across this one guy who's pretty good. Check out this clip.
Hi, I'm Josh Robert Thompson, and I'm a voice actor. Now, you may have heard my voice before on The Howard Stern Show as fake Arnold Schwarzenegger, or you might even have seen me on The Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson. Today, I'm going to give you an example of some of the voices that I can do.
So sometimes, you know, you might hear me talking like Arnold Schwarzenegger. A lot of people think that when you talk like Arnold, you have to go, but you idiot, Arnold doesn't talk like that. That's not an Arnold Schwarzenegger impression. That's a medical condition. Exactly. Maria, where the hell are my stogies?
And, you know, maybe I talk like this, you know. I look like maybe I just ate a lemon or something, you know. I got bad gas. Huh? You talking to me? Huh? I'll break your legs. I'll break your legs, put them back together, and I'll break them again.
You know, a lot of people ask me, hey, Sly, you're like 60-some years old. I mean, how were you able to, you know, do that new Rambo movie? It's two things. Number one, you got to believe in yourself. It's very important. Number two, take a lot of steroids.
And sometimes I might bring my voice down like this. And, oh, I'll start to talk like Morgan Freeman. And Morgan will talk like that. And, oh, he could talk about anything, really, make it an interesting topic. Like to talk about this carpet, for example. Oh, that carpet, the way it goes from wall to wall, just doing what it does, multiple colors, and I walk on you, sweet carpet. You keep my feet padded when they're bare. And,
all right.
Oh, I might stain you from time.
So, you know, it's pretty impressive, you know, it is. Actually, that one was for an honor view. Oh, man, the Rambo, because you have a man crush on Rambo, so that was an honor view. But it's impressive. If you actually didn't look at him and you just listened to him, he could actually pass for the legit deal, right? And that's usually what we think of when we think of imitation, that it's purely the physical attributes, that it's, you know, the physical expression. And up to this point with the Beatitudes, they've all been mainly physical expressions. They've been things that are action-oriented. And we come to the sixth beatitude here, and now it's entirely focused on the internal. Jesus says, he says, blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. And this is one of those verses, you know, that seems like a simple statement, but it's pretty difficult to fully understand. Really, I mean, it's just four words, you know, pure, heart, see, God. And those ideas are kind of simple, but when you put them together, it becomes really complex. You know, what does it really mean to be pure in heart? What does it mean to see God? You know, how do those two things, you know, work together? You know, why is that good for us? And I think another reason this is so difficult for us to really express and understand is that, you know, it's not something we easily connect with. We don't easily express this. You know, with the other ones, like, you know, being poor or, you know, mourning or showing mercy, right? Those are things that you've either felt before or maybe you've experienced, or there, you know, there's a tangible way to express those things. But when it's about, you know, being pure in heart, right, that's not easily expressed. And so before we jump in, I want you guys go ahead and read through the Beatitudes again from Matthew chapter 5. Verse 1 through 12, just, you know, to kind of refresh yourselves, remind what we've been talking about the past few weeks, and then to give you some context for what we're going to talk about this morning. But go ahead, grab your Bibles, turn to a couple people around you, and go ahead and read through Matthew 5, verses 1 through 12. I'll give you a couple minutes to read that to each other. All right. So in, you know, Matthew verse 8, this is how Jesus starts. He says, blessed are the pure in heart. And, you know, when we think about the heart, usually it's, you know, in terms of a metaphor, right? We associate it with our emotions, you know, with our drive, with our motivation. You know, for the Jewish culture back then, they actually associated the heart with more of the thinking process than the emotions. For them, the emotions were actually associated with, you know, the stomach, the gut. When it said that Jesus felt compassion, you know, they were actually describing him as he had this gut-wrenching reaction when he saw the crowds, you know, when he saw the suffering and the pain. And so for their culture, they saw that the heart was the center of, you know, understanding, of reasoning, of thinking. And so intellect was what drove them to do what they did. It drove them to commit to whatever they were committing to. But for us today, right, though, the heart is more the center of emotion, right? It's kind of the center of who we really are. And so regardless of, you know, how the heart is defined, you know, the similarities is that the heart really drives what you do. You know, throughout Scripture, we see that the heart is described as the source of our actions. You know, in Proverbs, it says everything we do flows from the heart. You know, and Jesus kind of, you know, he mentions this on multiple occasions when he says that, you know, what people say, what people think, is just a reflection of what's inside the heart. And so it seems like that most of our attention needs to be focused on developing our heart, right? Developing what we are internally. But it's a lot easier to develop what we are externally, right? It's just easier, you know, because it's visual, it's tangible, it's things that we can see. You know, recently, my daughter has been kind of getting into the whole dress-up thing. She discovered that. And we've been trying to, you know, hide that from her for as much as we could, but, you know, it was inevitable. You know, she had friends that would pass on, you know, dresses and costumes and things like that. And so she'd have these princess costumes, you know, full dresses with slippers and tiaras and, you know, all the accessories. And so, you know, she'd have her own little, you know, fashion show in her room. But lately, she hasn't been as into the dresses, but she's got this new ritual where after every time she takes a bath, she'll want to blow dry her hair, and then she'll want to brush it, and then she'll run to get this box of random accessories, and she'll put on like a hairband, she'll put on some beaded necklaces, she'll put on some bracelets, and then she'll put on these special green plastic glasses, right? This is actually what she looks like. And she'll want to go to sleep like that. She'll want to sleep, you know, in that what she's wearing. And so after she does this, she'll run up to me. She'll look for me. She'll run up to me, and she's like, "Daddy, do I look pretty?" Right? What am I supposed to say? right?
No, you actually look a little crazy.
But, you know, I'm like, of course, you know, you look beautiful, right? I mean, I love the green glasses. Nice touch. You know, but even at a young age, right, she's more concerned about, you know, kind of that outward appearance, that you know, that visual that's easier to work on. And so as parents, you know, we're always trying to balance that a little bit. So every time she asks if she's pretty, we're like, you are pretty, but don't forget, you need to be pretty on the inside too, right? So we're trying to hammer that home. But we're no different, right? We're no different. If we really look at, you know, where we spend the most of our energy and our time, it is on our externals, right? It's on our appearance. It's on our achievements, what we do at work, our actions, you know, how we present ourselves to other people. And, you know, what Jesus is saying, though, is it's the heart that's important, right? Because the heart is what drives your actions. It's what shapes your decisions. And, you know, Jesus talked about how, you know, with a good tree, it produces good fruit. With a bad tree, it produces bad fruit, right? What's on the inside will ultimately shape and determine what's on the outside, right? You could even try to seem like you have all the actions and appearance all together, right? But eventually, what's on the inside will come out. You know, earlier this summer, there was a huge thunderstorm that kind of swept through our neighborhood, did some damage. And we were out for dinner at the time. And when we came back home and drove up the driveway, I almost ran into this huge tree that had fallen in our backyard. And, you know, it actually fell right in the spot that we normally park. So it was actually a good thing we went out to eat. But, you know, yeah, here's a couple pictures I took the next morning. And, you know, I had my neighbor, he came over to help me, you know, chop up into small pieces, and we threw it in the back of our yard. So if anyone needs any firewood, I've got a ton of it. But, you know, we're trying to figure out how it fell. And, you know, I was looking at the trunk, you know, where it broke off, and I noticed a lot of black residue inside the tree. And so my initial thought was, I thought maybe lightning had hit it. You know, some lightning had hit and it struck it and, you know, charred it up and burned it, and so it fell over. But my neighbor, he actually explained it to me. He had been living there for, you know, decades across the street. And so he explained to me, he knew the previous owners years ago that lived there, and they actually used the backyard as kind of a makeshift car shop. And so they, since this was a really nice strong tree, they actually used the tree to hold up the car engines and stuff when they were working on cars. They would do oil changes right in that area, and, you know, probably they just dumped the oil right there. And so over time, you know, the tree just absorbed all the oil, the roots kind of just sucked it all up, and eventually it impacted the integrity of that tree. And so, you know, even though it looked strong on the outside, it was completely rotted out on the inside. And sometimes, you know, we like to fool ourselves to think that it's important to work on the exterior strength, right? That's what we need to devote our energy to. Jesus, you know, tells a story one time about this religious leader who showed up at a temple. And he gets up in the middle of the room and kind of waits for everyone to, you know, kind of give him their attention. And he starts to pray, right? It's actually more of an announcement than prayer. But he announces how he's thankful that, you know, he's not like the thieves and murderers and prostitutes of the world. And then he goes on to walk through his checklist of, you know, religious activities, right? He announces how he's given 10% of everything he has back to the temple. You know, he announces how he's really committed to fasting and prayer. And this is really just a picture, a snapshot of what a lot of the religious leaders in those days looked like, that they were so obsessed, you know, with this perfect image of trying to follow all these, you know, minuscule rules that they made up that were just nearly impossible to follow, right? But, you know, maybe that's what happens when you lose sight of the heart. Maybe that's, you know, that's why you become, you know, just focused on the externals. That's why maybe you become focused on, you know, what you do and your actions. And maybe that's why they lost their ability to understand what it means to be blessed, right? That they became more judgmental. They became they felt this sense of entitlement. But then Jesus kind of continues the story, and then he shifts his attention to this tax collector, you know, someone that in those days they viewed as a thief, as a traitor in the culture. And this guy, you know, he finds a dark corner in the temple, You know, he can't really take his eyes off the ground, and he's kind of beating himself, and he's saying, basically asking God simply just, you know, to have mercy because he's a sinner. He realizes that he has nothing to offer, right? He's simply asking, and he needs help with changing who he is on the inside, right? And what does that mean for us? You know, I think, you know, sometimes we do realize that we are broken on the inside, but a lot of times we end up focusing on trying to fix, you know, the outer symptoms, and we don't necessarily deal with what's really going on inside. You know, and maybe that's a starting place for us, that instead of focusing all our time and energy on what people see, maybe we should identify some things in our heart, you know, things that might need a little work on, you know, patience or compassion, you know, jealousy or anger. And the thing is, as you start to, you know, focus on these areas, you realize that it's not easy to deal with some of these things. And maybe that's the point, that it's not something that we can do on our own. You know, that maybe the heart is something that only God can actually change and deal with. And David understood this. You know, he wrote a lot about this in his poetry and his songs. In Psalm 51, right, this is after he had had an affair with, you know, another man's wife, and then after he had, you know, her husband murdered. He writes, you know, for God just to deal with his heart. You know, for God to kind of renew who he was inside. And maybe that's all we need to do. You know, maybe it doesn't seem groundbreaking, right? It seems disappointingly simple. But that's what the tax collector prayed, right? That's what David prayed, simply just to ask God to deal with who we are on the inside. And if we look back at the Beatitude, Jesus says, "Blessed are the pure in heart." And so he describes the heart as pure. And, you know, and the original word used there is katharos. This idea, it conveys this idea of, you know, unblemished, unmixed, you know, unadulterated. And, you know, that somehow the heart can't be a mixture, you know, of multiple influences or of multiple devotions. But instead, there's really only room for one. And, you know, and Jesus taught about this a little later when he says, you know, no one can serve two masters, right? You're either going to hate one and love the other, or you're going to be really committed to one or despise the other, right? You can't, it's not possible to serve both God and money. And so in trying to develop a heart that's pure, you know, nothing else should contaminate that desire to love God, right? That's what Jesus talks about when he told the lawyer, right? He said, this is the most important law to follow, that you love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and you love your neighbor as yourself. You know, but our heart has a tendency to wander. Right, it's torn between, you know, things that we selfishly want, and, you know, this way of life that God calls us to. About a month ago, we had Noah. Noah's, you know, over playing with Zachary, and they're still in this, you know, BFF stage. You know, still to this day, and you know, so we went out for dinner that night, and on the way back, we asked Noah if he wanted to, you know, spend the night, just, you know, for that night, and he starts mumbling, you know, in the background. He's like deep in thought. And he's like asking himself, you know, he's like, do I want to stay with Zachary tonight? Or do I want to go home and sleep with my family? Wow, this is a tough decision. And he's like, you know, he's having this conversation with himself in the back seat. And it's not like, you know, it's not like they hadn't seen each other in a long time. They see each other every day. But, you know, ultimately he did choose his family, which I think, you know, Gid and Karen were excited about because, you know, they beat out Zachary. You know, but there's a struggle internally that exists for all of us, right? And Paul understood this when he wrote to the church in Rome. You know, he said that, you know, he knows that there's good that he wants to do, but evil's always right there with him, right? He knows that there are things that he should do, but he ends up not doing those things. But there are also things that he knows he shouldn't do, and those are the things he ends up doing. And for us, you know, we face the same kinds of struggles every day, right? In what kind of parents we are, in what kind of husband or wife we are, in what kind of coworker we are, in what kind of neighbor we are. And in all those areas, right, is our heart uncontaminated so that we can actually love God and love people the way we're supposed to. You know, and in addition to being unblemished, you know, unmixed, I think the idea of being pure, it kind of defines something that's clean, right? Something that's not dirty. And I think we connect to that idea a little easier, you know, cleaning something, right? We wash our hands, we wash our clothes, we clean our houses, we clean our cars. You know, but how do you clean your heart, right? How do you clean your life? Eugene Peterson, the guy that wrote the Message translation, he kind of put it this way. He kind of gave the example of dirt. And he says that dirt is extraneous, you know, when it's on you or if it's on your clothes, because it doesn't belong there, right? It's in the wrong place. Dirt belongs in a garden, right? Not on you. And he goes on to talk about how life, you know, is just cluttered with stuff. You know, not necessarily all bad stuff, but sometimes stuff that doesn't belong. And so maybe the idea of cleaning your heart is more about decluttering, you know, and putting things in its proper place. And when I think of clutter, you know, a lot of us, when we think of clutter, we think of our homes, you know, our rooms, where it's just amazing how quickly, you know, things pile up, whether it's mail, you know, magazines, you know, clothes, you know, furniture. And the longer you stay in a house, the longer you stay at your apartment, right, you just accumulate more stuff. You know, and then you throw in a couple kids, right, and then the clutter explodes to another level. But TLC does this TV show called Hoarders, where they kind of follow the lives and the struggles of people that have a tendency to hoard. And it basically takes this idea of clutter to the fullest extreme, right? So check out this clip.
My house has 3 bedrooms, 2 bathrooms, and a finished basement. Really, none of the space in my house is usable. Can't sit in any rooms. The only room I really can use is my bedroom, where I can sort of sit in one spot on the bed and then move things around and lay down. Unless you have some kind of help or somebody that's, you know, showing it to you, it's real easy to walk by it every day to make believe it's not there.
You don't have to have money to hoard or to collect things. People are always willing to give you things because a lot of people want to get rid of things. And people call me constantly or come to me and say, I have this and that and the other, and would you like it? And if I can fit it in my vehicle, I do.
But Judy hasn't always been so frugal. Though currently unemployed, she has a history of obsessive shopping and over the years has racked up thousands in credit card debt.
One of my compulsions is buying something that's a really good deal. Well, these are bags of clothes I have to go through and try to return by a certain date so I can get it off my credit card, and some things I had bought for the rental house, which I have to return.
Right. You know, and I know there's a lot more behind the scenes, right? I mean, there are people that actually do have serious, you know, disorders, and it's difficult for them to get rid of stuff. It's difficult for them, you know, not to buy compulsively. You know, but I think another part of it, like she was mentioning, is that they just become numb, you know, to the piles of stuff around them. You know, they see it day in and day out, and it just stops bothering them. And, you know, it just becomes an acceptable part of their lives. And for us, you know, what are some of those things that clutter our lives, you know, that you know, keep us from engaging with God? You know, what are some of those things that take up space in our hearts, in our emotions, you know, in our thoughts? You know, maybe we have some distractions. Maybe, you know, we have addictions. Maybe we have negative influences. And they've just, you know, they just keep sticking around, you know, like the piles of stuff in our homes. And it's gotten to the point where they're around so long that it just becomes an acceptable part of our lives. And, you know, it's just as important, though, to realize there are some, you know, good things that also clutter our lives. You know, things like our jobs or our families or even some of our hobbies. And maybe for us, in trying to develop a pure heart, instead of focusing just on removing things from our lives, maybe we need an approach and a perspective that's more about trying to create space for what belongs. You know, that we try to increase the space where God can actually reside and have a presence. And being pure in heart isn't, you know, simply about removing what's unclean, but it's also about creating space to allow God to work on our hearts. And so maybe something practical is the discipline of, you know, solitude or silence, where it just helps us in that process of replacing the clutter in our hearts and being a little more single-minded in how we pursue God. And then Jesus finishes off this beatitude by saying, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God." And that's the consequence of having a pure heart, right? That's the result. And in the original language, the word "see" is actually in this future continuous tense. Like, it's an ongoing thing. So maybe it's, you know, better translated as, you know, they will be continually seeing God. And, you know, maybe it might have been a bit unexpected for the people that were listening to Jesus to hear this, because the majority of Jewish history, when it comes to how they, you know, relate with God, it was always more focused on hearing and not seeing, right? Throughout the Old Testament, it was always about how the people would listen to what God said. It was about the prophets being the voice of God. And even in how they engaged with God, they saw him as a listening God, you know, a God that would hear their prayers. And, you know, so this statement would definitely get their attention. You know, especially in ancient days where it was extremely rare for people to, you know, be in the presence of a king or even much less see a king. And so up to this point, no one had actually physically seen God before. You know, maybe the closest person would have been Moses, right? Where after, you know, he led the Israelites, you know, out of slavery, you know, he helped them escape from Egypt. And, you know, God wants Moses to lead these people, take them to the promised land. But he, you know, he feels really inadequate as a leader. You know, he needs constant reassurance from God. And so he even asks God to show himself. But God tells him that's, you know, there's a slight problem with that. It's not really a good idea, right? Because if anyone sees my face, they die, right? It's a slight problem. And so for God, he does want to show just a small portion of himself. So they work out an arrangement where, you know, Moses hides in this, you know, small cleft inside a rock. And as God's walking by, he puts his hand to cover Moses. And as he passes all the way through, he takes his hand off so that Moses can just catch a glimpse of God's back as he's leaving. And that's the closest that anyone has seen him. But if we look back at the word "see," you know, the word used there also means more than just, you know, a physical act of seeing. But, you know, it's this idea of maybe, you know, perspective or an awareness. It conveys this idea of knowing someone, you know, intimately and personally, right? Because if there's transparency between people, right, you see them for who they really are. You know, that's why when we know someone's true intentions or true motives, we say that we see right through them. You know, for example, like sometimes certain days I'll, you know, clean the kitchen in the middle of the day. Or I'll start, you know, working on fixing up some things in the house in the middle of the week. And Rachel sees me doing these things, but she's aware that it's a bit odd, right? And she, you know, she eventually makes the connection that it's probably because I want to do something later that night, and I'm just, you know, trying to soften her up. And so she makes that connection. So she asks me, you know, she's like, "Okay, so do you have basketball tonight or something? You know, are you playing softball tonight?" I'm like, "Maybe," right? But she knows me, right? She knows who I really am, and she sees through that. And, you know, Jesus is saying that if you want to see God, right, if you want to know who he really is, right, the requirement is a pure heart. And, you know, as I was trying to figure out this beatitude, you know, and trying to understand, you know, how we see God, the process seems kind of impossible, right? Because if you want to see God, then you have to have a pure heart. But as you're, you know, genuinely taking a look inside yourselves and you're genuinely trying to develop a pure heart, you realize that you don't have a pure heart. You realize that it's really difficult to develop a pure heart. And so, you know, maybe in order for us to see God, you know, it's not that we need to try harder in developing a pure heart. Maybe it's not that we need to strain more to try to see God. You know, but maybe it's actually in our brokenness that we do see God. That, you know, sometimes it seems like it's always the sinners that see God and not necessarily the people that feel entitled or feel like they deserve it. You know, sometimes it's always the people that know they don't have a pure heart that end up seeing God, not necessarily the people that feel like there's nothing wrong with them inside. You know, and it's maybe when we realize that we can't develop a pure heart, that's when God opens our eyes, and that's when he helps make our heart pure. And if you look at the life of Paul, it kind of reflects this idea. You know, at one point in his life, he's like the elite religious leader, right? He's got an incredible resume, right? He's got the right bloodline. He's got the right training. You know, he's got the discipline to follow all these laws that, you know, down to the minute details. And he's got this devotion. He's so devoted to the Jewish law that he actually is willing to terrorize and to imprison and to even order the execution of some of these people in the early church. And maybe in his mind, he sees that he's pretty close to perfection, right? That he's pretty close to imitating God in his way of life. But on one of his trips, when he's traveling to the city of Damascus, you know, he gets a glimpse of God. And Jesus, you know, blinds him with this bright light in the middle of the road, and he ends up, you know, not being able to see. He ends up blind. And he has this conversation with Jesus that ends up turning his life upside down. And from that point on, you see a reversal in his understanding of what it means to have a pure heart, right? And you see that reflected in his writings. You know, when he's talking to the church in Rome, right, he says that there's this internal struggle that he just can't seem to get a hold of. He can't seem to get a control over, right? And maybe he realizes that there's nothing he can do to change himself inside. You know, when he's writing to the Philippians, he says that, you know, even with all these amazing spiritual accomplishments that he has, right, even with, you know, all this intense, incredible spiritual resume that he has on file, those were the things that actually prevented him from seeing and knowing who God is. And, you know, and so maybe he realized that developing a pure heart wasn't something that he could do, right? But he realized that it's really Christ that gives us that pure heart, right? It's nothing we deserve. We're just on the receiving end of it. You know, so for us, maybe we just need to remember that it all comes back and it's all about God's grace, right? That, you know, because our lives are broken, because we're selfish, right? We need forgiveness. We need somehow to be able to clean the mess up inside. And so, you know, being in a state of brokenness, being in a state of rejection, that's when Jesus decides to love us. That's when he decides to sacrifice his life for us. And in doing that, he's able to give us that pure heart. And so maybe as we try, you know, as we try to create space in our hearts, as we try to remove some of that clutter, maybe we'll get a better understanding of what Jesus meant when he said, "Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God." Let's pray.